Good afternoon. Thank you for spending your sunny Saturday afternoon with us here at the gallery. My name is Katie Mitchell. I am very fortunate to be the coordinator here at Arat Gallery Tama. Today's artist talk is the opening celebration for weaving matter material experimentation. We will be recording the audio of today's talk in the hopes of making the talk available online after the event. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather this afternoon, the Jabiru'ong and Eastern Maa peoples. I pay my respects to their ancestors past and elders present. I acknowledge that the First Nations across this continent have never ceded sovereignty, and that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This exhibition, Weaving Matter, Material Experimentation, was curated by Liz Williamson, a revered artist, curator, writer, and educator. In March last year, we hosted Liz's touring exhibition, Weaving Eucalypts Project, and Liz presented an artist talk for us, which was also, the exhibition was in this room and the talk was in this room. And the talk was one of our most popular events of 2023. Around that time, Liz told me about a group exhibition that she was curating at the Australian Design Centre in Sydney called Weaving Matter, Materials and Context. And she told me that she was already thinking about a second iteration of the exhibition for the artists to continue their experimentations. It was an ideal fit for Arat's dedication to textiles and fibre. Liz passed away suddenly 2 months ago in mid-August. With the support of Liz's family and the exhibiting artists, we proceeded with exhibition preparations in Liz's honour. Liz was a dedicated supporter of Arat Gallery Tama, with a long history as an exhibitor here, and she was a champion of our specialisation in textiles and fibre. In the time that I have been in this role, Liz has been a generous and kind collaborator and mentor. I will miss her greatly, and I have mourned her absence in preparing for this exhibition over the last 8 weeks. Liz had planned to travel to Ararat to oversee the install this week and to lead the panel discussion today. In reshaping today's event, I approached one of the exhibiting artists, Ilka White, who, as well as a respected artist and teacher, is an experienced facilitator, and I asked Ilka to take on the task of leading today's discussion. Joining Ilka in discussion today are Blake Griffiths from Sydney and Monique van Nieuwland from Canberra. Also in attendance today are exhibiting artists Amanda Ho and Jacqueline Stojanovic. I thank the exhibiting artists for their commitment to this exhibition at an incredibly sad time. And further thanks go to the Australian Design Centre team in Sydney for their support. And I also want to acknowledge that some of Liz's family are here today. Thank you so much for making the journey to Ararat. Ararat Gallery Tama is a cultural facility of Ararat Rural City Council with funding support from state government through Creative Victoria. We value this support from local and state government to bring enriching cultural experiences to our community in regional Victoria. I will now hand over to Ilka. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, for all of the work and heart that you've put into making sure this went ahead. Anna and Heather, I can see two empty seats from where I sit. Come, make yourselves comfortable, please. If there's anyone else standing, I'm sure there's a few others throughout, and you could even sit as a mascot at the front if you'd rather not be on a chair. I just don't want you being uncomfortable. Thanks everybody for coming. It's a great solace to me to have this gathering. I wasn't able to make Liz's memorial service in Sydney, so this has been a time of solitary reckoning with Liz's loss. And it's great to be together with some other people who knew and loved her. And I'm really grateful particularly to Jen, Hugh, Tess and Jen for being here as family representatives. I'm going to be on and off with the glasses. I'm of that age. Liz championing of weaving has been very present to me as I prepare for today, along with her ambition, her forethought, her networking, her technique, discernment, restraint, mentoring, and above everything, her care. When I told my family I'd like to become a weaver, they said, "Oh, like Liz." It was great to have somebody who'd tread the path before me so it wasn't a completely unknown thing. I saw when I applied to RMIT textile design, I saw a sample pinned to the notice board which took my attention immediately, such that I forgot my preparations for the interview and was absorbed in this piece of cloth that it turned out Liz had woven from her time there. And that piece of cloth and Liz's larger body of work has been an inspiration to me right through my career. There are so many other anecdotes I'd love to share about Liz. Maybe we can do a bit more of that after the talk. Oh dear, this is going to be tricky. I'd like to invite the other exhibiting artists here to share briefly something of Liz's place and role in their weaving lives. Before I finish my section, I just want to say I'm wearing a piece I wove many years ago for an exhibition that Liz opened at Craft Victoria in Melbourne, an exhibition called White Work. It was a really formative show for me, and it was a great honour at the time to have Liz offer to come down from Sydney and open it. And on that score, I just want to share a little message that Jane, who can't be here, her work, beautiful work, is hanging over there on the wall. Jane said that if she'd been here, she would like to have shared how much she values Liz's contribution to Australian creative life in general and to her creative life. She opened Jane's last solo show and Jane was honoured that Liz bought Conflagration Regeneration, which is the second work along the line there, from last year's iteration of Weaving Matter. She said, "As an amateur weaver, it meant a great deal to me to have that a weaver of her calibre saw something in this piece." I agree with Liz. She's got good taste. It's a beautiful piece, Jane. And, could I hand maybe to Monique for your thoughts?
I think we all met Liz at different times in her career. I knew of Liz's work from the work that she did mostly at Sturt, where it was very colourful, squared, double weave shawls and interior design pieces that she created. Then later in the 90s, she became the lecturer at ANU School of Art, where I was the technician, the go-to body for everything else that needed doing in the workshop at the time. So it was really good working with her. She was not always that easy to work for because she had high standards. But she was always very inclusive and inviting people into new ventures and had something on the back burner that people could be involved with. We still had a few things on the back burner, but we'll see where they go.
Thanks, Monique. Blake?
Yeah. Liz. Hi. I first met Liz through university. I didn't actually ever have her as a teacher, surprisingly, but I had done a year of studying weaving at the National Institute of Design in Ahmedabad, and Liz, unbeknownst to me at the time, but Liz had obviously a long-standing relationship working with NID and craftspeople more generally in India. And so Liz was very impressed with that and so started really our friendship. And I worked weaving in Liz's studio for many years after I returned from India, but more so just hung out a lot at the studio and helped helped Liz pull off some of these kind of projects. So it was a total pleasure to be under her mentorship, really, in many aspects of my life.
Blake, your eulogy at Liz's funeral was quite a beautiful, beautiful thing. It had me in tears from Melbourne watching online. Thank you for it. I wanted to invite Jacqueline to share. Can I just hand the mic to you?
I first met Liz in 2022 in Sydney at UNSW Galleries. She came to the panel discussion of the exhibition Pliable Planes, which I had work in. And after the talk, she bought me a coffee and said, "When you're in Sydney next, come to my house. I want to show you my looms." And so a couple months later, when I was back in Sydney, I visited her and Ilka. You were there as well, I believe. and she was so generous. She made me muffins and she knew I was going on residency in Prato and being close to Florence, where she had studied at the Fondazione Liceo for silk jacquard weaving. She told me I have to go there, and in that very moment, she sat down and looked online for when the courses would be. So she very much organised this for me and set me on this path of jacquard and cloth weaving.
I met Liz from afar. I never really knew her in person, but I met her for the very first time at the World Shibori Symposium in Hong Kong in 2011, organised by Yoshiko Wada. And I think that was a bit of a turning point in my weaving life. I also did a double weave workshop with her at Wangaratta. And I think at that workshop she signed the book and said, "You never know where weaving will take you." So it's not just literally where it will take you, but just all the people that you will come into contact with and meet. And I was also in a group exhibition with her, organised by Di Magan from her gallery in Milawa, and Liz bought one of my scarves, and I think that was the high point of my short weaving career at the time as well. Yeah, so. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Amanda. I think many of us are wrapped in Liz today. I know I've got her around me because I've just recently had a bad cold, so she's still caring for us all. I think Liz's choice of the title of this show, Weaving Matter, is a brilliant one. It seems simple, but if you think about matter, matter is physical substance. It's what we make things from. But it's also what's significant, what has value. It's sort of the essence of meaning, what matters. And that's also what we make things from. So I just take my hat off to Liz for the understated brilliance that she brought to so much of what she did. And kick off this discussion by thinking also on the subtitle, Material Experimentation. There's been a lot of experimentation by the artists in this room, and a few who are not here. Christine's use of metal wire and a variety of fibres. This is the black work done and the shiny copper, including basalt, fancy weaving with basalt. Hannah's experiments with glass rods and fishing line, which were the precursors to these golden glowing works, which originally were planned to have glass rods as the weft. So weaving with glass rods, go figure. It didn't go as she'd thought, and so in her beautiful way, Hannah just moved sideways as Annie Albers, Liz's great teacher, one of Liz's teachers, recommended. Play, experiment, see where it leads you. And Jennifer's use of carbon and paper and resin. Jennifer's work's the last one on the right, down the wall there. All speak to material experimentation, and there are many more examples, but I've got a lot to cover here. Also, Jane's exploration of horsehair in that work I mentioned earlier as a weaving material. So Liz references Annie Albers, the Bauhaus, famous Bauhaus weaver, and there's a quote from her on the wall there that sparked this initial show. And Annie said, "Something speaks to us, a material, a medium. Ideas flow from it to us, and though we feel to be the creator, we are involved in a dialogue with our medium. The more subtly we are tuned into our medium, the more inventive our actions will become. What I'm trying to get across is that material is a means of communication, that listening to it, not dominating it, makes us truly active. That is, to be active, be passive. That's a lot harder to do than it is to say." Kelly, whose work's in the middle here, has literally listened to her materials. She's wired her metal threads up, her mining cables, to amplifiers and actually listened to the mining happening underneath Broken Hill. But in other subtler ways, listening might be otherwise described as tuning into, feeling, getting to know. So I wanted to ask Monique and Blake, does this quote from Annie ring true for you? Do you have an example of this communication or dialogue of material speaking to you? And I'll ask Monique and Amanda if you'd like to share your response to that too afterwards. Monique.
Yeah. As weavers, we have to respond. Things have functions, and functional weaving for domestic textiles has always been about what will the end result be, what will it do, does it need to absorb, does it need to stop light coming through. So weavers are in tune with what a thread or what a material can do. In biowork, I wasn't necessarily working with ready-made yarns or materials produced already for me. I had to source, and for these works, I was looking at rubbish. So I literally one day looked at my surrounds around a dog park, and I picked up four things just like that that I could turn into weaving. But I had to listen to the material, what it would do. And for instance, the chip packet proved quite a bit of problems. The bottom left one. So I had to find out a way of cutting the material of a packet of potato chips in a way that I could actually wind and weave with. So, yeah, I suppose that's how I've been listening to the material that I want to do something with, to say something and make something happen for the viewer, to make it actually work for me, that I can weave it. Is that okay?
Yeah, similar for me, I think. I mean, a lot of my practice, maybe not so much these works, is about material, is about the transformation of material, like particularly focusing on taking, not always waste, but something that has been assigned really low value in an economic sense. And I suppose it's more of a wrestle rather than listening to the material, how can I transform the property of this material to elevate its perceived value or its aesthetic value. And really my entire studio practice is about you know, first of all, always starting with a place usually, but thinking about a material from that place and how can I transform this I'm choosing through the process of weaving to elevate its value in some way. So, you know, for these works that I have here, I was looking at Icelandic wool. I made them in Iceland. So, you know, as a kind of inroad to start thinking about this specific textile history of the place where they were made, but also to transform this kind of raw material to become something useful, something beautiful, something practical. And recently I've been working a lot with tanned fish skin, which is the same, this kind of byproduct that through this grapple in the studio can become this usable material. So it is you need to listen to the material to be able to understand its inherent properties, how it's going to sit, what's it going to do with my work. But for me, it's also, there is a kind of resistance in the sense that I know I want to manipulate that material to make it weavable. And like that with your work as well, like, you know, it has to undergo this process to be able to be used in a woven sense. Whether that qualifies as listening, I'm not sure.
I'm going to include wrestling in my definition of of listening. Actually, I quite enjoy wrestling as a way to get to know somebody. So, all kinds of tuning into and getting to know. Listening is in the way that Annie speaks. She's talking about tuning into materials relating as a lot to their touch, to their hardness or softness. And many of the artists in this work, in this show, emphasise the importance of texture, touch, and the physical properties of their materials in creating meaning in their work. I'm thinking of Hannah's attempt to capture light and movement in these works, Jane's use of horsehair for its unique tactile quality, Jennifer's creation of ethereal translucent presence in her work, and Jacqueline's exploration of texture in her velvet samples. Listening and feeling and tuning into and wrestling, seeking to understand basically all the ways under which all the things we might think about in terms of listening, is an essential part of improvising, which is a form of play. And Annie encouraged playfulness in weaving, as did Liz. Liz here in the corner, I hope you get a chance to look at these works up close if you've not done so yet. Lise literally is, in one of these works at least, taking a thread for a walk, which is a nod to Annie's pictorial weavings and to her notion of taking a thread for a walk after her teacher, Paul Clay. And Jackie, in terms of play, Diptych was woven, this one here, was woven from a collection of Italian crossword puzzles purchased at newsstands in Prato, which have been interpreted as weaving drafts for a Countermarsh loom while in residence. Jackie, did you want to comment on that? About play?
So I was on the residency for 2 months in Prato at Lotto Zero, which is a textile centre, and I just finished a course at the Liceo, which was all about jacquard weaving. And for anyone who's ever tried it or knows about it, it's incredibly driven by design. So everything has to be decided before the actual outcome through a series of punch cards. And I kind of wanted to break this up a little bit after weeks of, you know, just doing the same motion again and again and again and knowing what the design was going to be like. And I wanted to have a little bit less pressure on myself as the one controlling what the design would be, but rather find a kind of randomness in my current environment, which was the squares in Prato. And obviously when you're in a new place and you don't speak the language as well as you'd like and, you know, everything's a bit unfamiliar, you're always looking for these little signifiers and associations that do make sense to you. And for me, when I would pass these stands, I'd see those crossword puzzles and looking with a weaver's gaze, I thought, oh, that looks very familiar to me. And I started to collect them and see how they were translated on the loom, and it resulted in 14 metres of fabric with 14 different crossword puzzles changing every metre, the different colour. And I think I do that a lot in my practice. I try to invite the everyday world around me into the outcomes.
I find it interesting because a different take on random playfulness. Other people have responded to music to tunes or to temperature changes, to timelines. So it's a nice variation of that. It's lovely.
That's true. It's a lovely point. I had a weaving student after introduction, first class. He's a composer, and he went home and composed a piece based on our four structures that were threaded on the loom that day. If anyone's seen weave notation for a four-shaft loom, it looks very much like the stave. And so he composed a piece with four different instruments, playing each of the twill, rosepath, bird's eye, herringbone, and overlapped them, and it was absolutely beautiful. It was so orchestral. I want to quote Liz on discovering handloom weaving. She said, "A beautiful logical system. Everything had to be in its place. It suited my personality." And I've been learning recently from Blake how incredibly organised Liz was, so that everything in its place is quite literally in Liz's home. If I inherit anything from Liz, I hope that's amongst it, is that organisational everything in its place capacity. It's something I'm currently lacking. Annie advocated for accepting accidents in the creative process, accidents that could lead to unexpected or innovative effects or new directions in weaving. So between the logical everything in its place, between planning and order, and play, improvisation, experimentation, accident, risk, what are the various places in your practice, Monique and Blake, for these various ways of being? Blake?
To weave on the loom, I mean, most people here probably understand what that is, but you have to have your warp, you have to have a warp set up. So for me, when I'm trying to maybe conceptualize a new work or make a new surface, in reality, it's usually because it's the end of another work that, and you have a little bit of space left on your loom, and then it's kind of a bit uninhibited. You can just kind of go for it and play. Those samples are usually the most successful for my practice, because it's a chance to, for me, shove whatever the hell is around in the loom and see how it plays, and then work out, okay, is it structurally sound, and then go away and have an idea about how you can come back and refine that. But generally, that's my approach, is like setting up these test warps with various materials. A lot of my work early on is using just yarn that I got from Reverse Garbage. Sydney people will know what that is. That's like ex-hosiery stock, so like really, really super fine, like what stockings would be knitted from. Which is almost like it almost becomes an invisible warp because it's so fine. It takes a really long time to set up, but because of that, I'm able to really concentrate on what the weft material is doing. And even though the final work might use, you know, a thicker yarn or a cotton or a linen or something, but because I've made it in that way where there's almost no warp because it's so fine, I can understand how the weft is going to play, if that makes sense. And those samples, like I just have a lot of those, just, you know, 15 by 15 centimetre things lying around from when I started weaving, that I can go back to and reference if I have this material that like acts in this certain way. Like, okay, I know leather's going to do this, leather cording is going to do this, like I know, you know, shampoo tubs cut up is going to do this. And so I've kind of got this reference library. They're not weaving drafts per se, but like my version of how I know these structures are going to work for these different materials.
Yannick, yeah.
Liz mentioned in one of her speeches in one of her writings that she found it quite frustrating having to go through all these samples when she learned to weave. But I think she learned a lot doing them, and she was ready then to cut through and try other things that suited her more. So I feel a loom is like a tension box, I always tell my students. So you're taught to weave at the right tension so your weft packs up nicely. But that's where you can break the rule. So when I teach, I would say stick something else, loosen something, cut something and see what happens. And that's where I think that's the playful way of going about it. Of course, you have to follow the rules, but then you're ready to break them once you understand the rules. Yeah, and the other thing that Liz did in the last few years, and coincidentally, I did the same in Canberra with a fellow weaver, Melanie Auld. We ran a few workshops with people who had learned to weave, and then we did a lucky dip, and Sutton had a game on the loom where you would draw out little tickets and say, try to make it shiny or something, or make it look angry.
Do it upside down. Do it upside down.
For instance. So, and that's a lovely thing. And so Liz, the last few times we spoke, we were talking about the experiment, working with students, doing these crazy little challenges. And she said, yeah, what about weave with sugar? You know, we're both thinking about how we could weave with sugar. So that's the way it's very playful to think about, what the material can do for you.
Thank you. I might just share as well that my work of late has been far less planned and ordered than it has been in the past. So I've been feeling my way into the vulnerability of that and finding that releasing or relinquishing control has been one of the best components. Sort of understanding that my role is as a conduit rather than a director, and being malleable enough to take direction from my material or process. And it feels like a big turning of a corner that when that notion started to sink in, and I've been reflecting on how interesting it is that the works that have come since then in some ways are simpler and simpler than the previous, what might seem more accomplished works. So I'm learning to be comfortable with that, and because I really value the process and what I'm learning from the process. And in preparing for this talk, I realised that there are quite a lot of other people who do this. Something I came to is thinking of weaving or making anything. Making as a way of thinking through making, and the feedback loop between making, thinking, and having one affect the other. It's been really nice. I thank Katie for asking me into this role, for the new things I've come across as I've been looking around a bit. Monique and Blake, I also would love it if you could share your thoughts about textiles, particularly Monique, you mentioned this early, about textiles breaking new ground and being at the forefront, as you said.
Well, I think textiles was always at the foreground because we needed to be clothed, we needed shelter, as Annie Albers also mentioned to her students when she was teaching them the beginnings of weaving. There's different ways of being textiles being in the foreground. You have it in sports, you know. They develop new technology for faster swimming suits, you know, more stretchy clothing for the rowers. I don't know, I'm making something up now. There's also the circus and dance that uses textiles extensively. That is very useful in their pursuits, what they want to express. And then there's technology going into space. But recently also the Archibald Prize, for instance, suddenly had a painting, not suddenly, but there was a painting with jeans in there. And people went, oh, wow, that speaks, that really tells a story about this character in this portrait. So I think textiles is recognisable, is visceral, it's familiar, and I think that's why it will always be speak to us and be somehow in the foreground. And future developments, yeah, we'll see where that takes us with, you know, conductivity, healing cloths. I was involved with an experiment with bee silk that they try to create fabrics for military purposes originally. So people would wear clothing that would have healing qualities, so they wouldn't need necessarily to get extra special dressings. It would be something that they would already be wearing. So yeah, it's just interesting where it all goes. Yeah, is that enough?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think also that's potentially, well, it's a major contributor to, well, the university sector or textile departments at universities, and why there's this big resurgence is because acknowledging that textiles, that more often than not, innovation in all fields kind of can be drawn back to textiles, and recognizing why textile knowledge in terms of the structures, like the technical knowledge of weaving, is so important. You know, I'm thinking of like IKEA have this really stupid video on YouTube that's a world without textiles, and you know, there's like nothing. There's nothing. It's just like naked people walking around. You know, like, in a, you know, from gyprock, like the way gyprock is even constructed, like the chairs you're sitting on, like there's not, there's, n- it's, it, it affects every tiny part of our life that, I mean, it has to be at the forefront of innovation. And, you know, particularly now, at this moment in the world where textile production is so responsible for so many of the ills of our world, there's an obligation, you know, at an educational level to be thinking how that can be undone or at least slowed down in a way which is, you know, where we're at the moment. I mean, if textile production ceased tomorrow, I think we would be fine for quite a significant amount of time, but we would rediscover these ways to actually, you know, rearrange our relationship with the materials that are around us. And also playing a new role in new materials, algae, you know, biomaterials that we're only just discovering. So, yeah, it's playing a huge role.
Yeah. I'm thinking also...
No, you go.
I bet we were going to mention the same thing. Thinking also of... most weavers are very familiar with this, the origin of the computer coming from the Jacquard loom, leading to the works we see behind us of Monique's, for example. And binary code, you know, coming from the punch card. So, yeah, textiles have driven innovation and change a long while. There's quite a bit. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to say something else. I was saying a post-coal, post-oil world will require us to rethink what we have as natural resources. And I think that's where textiles will have a lot to answer and discover... combining different fibres together to create qualities that maybe the coal and oil provided us first. Mm. Yeah. Mm. But you mentioned that with algae and stuff like that too.
Yeah, I might mention now also the fibre shed movement, which is bringing the awareness that we've brought previously to our pantry in the way of slow food, biodynamics, organics, food miles, all of that awareness, to our wardrobes, and realising that the impact of our wardrobes probably in excess of that of our food consumption. So the fibre shed movement has spread worldwide now, and the challenge is to think about your bioregion and think about how we could work, how we could support ourselves and provide for our textile needs within our own bioregion. So I hope textiles might... push forward in that kind of direction too into the future. Just in the way of innovation and technical integration, technological integration, there's a bit of that here in Jennifer's use of a complex 32-shaft hand loom to produce that extraordinary piece at the far right there, which took 14 shuttles working independently. If anybody's tried a double cloth, just try bulking that up to 14. And Blake's use of digitised weaving drafts from the Icelandic Textile Centre. Did you want to comment on that, Blake?
Oh, I can quickly. I mean, it's looking back to look forwards, but these my work's just here, are just using, well, not just using, they're using a weaving draft that was was an archive that was going to Rack and Ruin that the Icelandic Textile Centre have digitised, you know, just to retain these different and relatively ancient in terms weaving drafts. And again, in terms of technological development, now they're relatively simple, but at their moment were cutting edge technology, working out how to make waterproof fabric.
Thinking also of Kelly's use of conductive wire to transmit environmental energies, and of Monique's jacquards. Monique, did you just want to speak through the process of technology that you used to construct these works?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it briefly. I always loved incorporating images in my work, and that in the beginning would have been cut up pictures that I took, that I made, and I wove it in, sometimes in a 3D fashion, sometimes printed on plastic, so I was trying to find different ways of using see-through imagery as well. Then I got my hands on a draw loom, which is like a damask loom where you can pull up units to create images. That's all quite slow. But Liz, at the time, in the early 2000s, she she invited Louise Lemieux-Berube from Canada, who was a well-known jacquard teacher and weaver. And so she taught a course, and then I thought, that's what I want. I really would like a loom that could do that thing. And so the technology is the binary code where each thread is controlled individually. And that means in small sections, you can just show a few of the threads, and in other sections, you can show a lot of the threads on the loom. And that will create different shades that you can weave with. So you can weave nice pictures, but that's not enough. And so I felt like the technology I had to do other things with rather than weave a nice dotted fabric or swirly fabric. I might like to do that one day as well. But so then I started using other materials, and that's what you see the result here. Interestingly, these five works on the left, they were a picture that I created that I reduced into a weave that would read, hopefully, what I would like to show. Once I started weaving, I knew I would just weave it, and I knew it would finish. So the other two pieces, I had an image that I worked on. I had reduced, and it would work well. If I just wove it black and white, it would work. But I chose to use other materials, and that's where I almost became a tapestry weaver. So even though it's a technology that I used to create the backbone of the piece, I actually was quite scared at times that I hoped I had the right colour. I had my little sketch on the side, and sometimes I changed my mind and I didn't know what would come next. But, yeah, that's just even though the technology is super bright and clever, you still have to do the work to make it work. Yeah.
And if you've not read or looked closely at these works, these two over this side are woven from fast fashion, ex-fashion garments that have been worn out and cut up fine and woven as weft. And I should have let everyone know at the beginning, for those not weavers, we're talking warp and weft like everybody understands what we're talking about. The warp are the long threads on the loom, the long ways ones. If you buy a bolt of cloth, they run in the direction of the selvage, and the weft is the thread that crosses at right angles to that from side to side, back and forth, and that's carried by a shuttle on the loom. Thanks, Monique. It's good to know a little bit more about the process. Blake, in my looking about and reading and thinking and mulling over today, I came across your reference to textile thinking. And I'm really curious if it's possible to summarise it briefly, what textile thinking is.
I reference textile thinking a lot when I'm having to, at the 11th hour, write a statement. But I like, I kind of like the field of textile thinking. I think, I mean, it makes sense, really, in the grand scheme of the world. But it's had a bit of a moment in the academic world as an alternative way of talking about design thinking, about design process, and and returning that to be about textiles, given textiles as a structure has this opportunity to really think about tacit knowledge about the emotional connection, how things feel, how things are articulated with a very technical process, and that it's that tacit knowledge in terms of like we have a reaction to textiles that is sometimes missing from more formal design process or has been historically. And so textile thinking is a way of, or making textiles is a way of kind of bridging the creative and the technology. But I suppose further for me in my practice, it's really about thinking about everything mediated through textile making, like a place, thinking about it from a textile position. And really that's been a focus in me to return making cloth to this embodied process where there's not an element of my work that I can't explain its purpose or its purpose in it from a textile perspective. So if I'm using wool, if I'm making a work about a place in Australia and I'm using wool from that farm, then I'm constantly challenging myself to think about that, A, can I do this from scratch? And I know that this is something that pervades Ilka's in the garden also, but do I have the knowledge to be able to justify this thing from you know, raising a sheep, raising a lamb, to feeding a sheep, to shearing a sheep? Like, what impact has that sheep had on the soil of this place? And how can that entire process be distilled in a work? And so I'm not thinking about textiles while I'm doing that. I'm thinking about place. And I suppose that's really what I'm getting at when I'm saying textile thinking, because it could be completely irrelevant to the work I'm making. It's more about this entire process. For me, really, more than anyone, because often that's not, you don't get that from seeing the work. But textiles is particularly handy, or the woven form is particularly handy to be able to explain that, because you do have this clear intersection of a warp and a weft, so you can attach an idea. I can tell you, like, I'm telling you the warp is representing this emotional aspect, and I can tell you the weft is talking about waste, and we can start to uncover where these things overlap and how they intersect and what that means. So quite often I'm looking at opposing forces or opposing ways to do things in my work, mostly about consumption, but then on the other hand, you know, something completely sustainable and embodied, and like, what does that mean when these things are in tension?
Yeah, I'm glad you said tension, because I've been thinking about that, and you mentioned tension, Monique. Maybe not in this work, but in a lot of your other works, Blake, I feel like there's these seeming contradictions or binaries, and what you're doing is bringing the two together and, yeah, thinking of those as a warp and a weft, say the physical and the spiritual, or the positive and the negative, or the perceived positive versus the perceived negative. I think it's a really important modality, that way of thinking for our future, because binary thinking is pretty dead end, yeah. So I'm really grateful for that introduction to that concept, or giving a name to it, I guess, something that I'd not had a word for before. Obviously tension is essential to cloth. Do you think it's also essential to art?
I have a reputation in my real world job, which is working in galleries and museums, because I am a big fan of that. I think, you know, as a maker, working in the world of making exhibitions, and also as a maker, personally, I think it's a great relationship, because I can distance myself from my work in terms of caring so much about what I want people to think and get out of it or do. And at work, I get to really think about audiences, how people how people engage with the visual world and visual literacy, and how spaces like this can mediate, you know, between a work and a person. And I think tension is good. I've curated shows that have been like on you know, too left-leaning politically, and it's been too much of a challenge for people to understand. And I'm fascinated by why that is so. When this object is, you know, just on the wall, it's not an offensive physically. It's not a threat. But also curated shows that are too easy to look at, and there's no tension, and also be unsuccessful. So, you know, thinking about making an exhibition in the same way you would think about making cloth is kind of the way I go about it, in terms of thinking about these oppositions, or not oppositions, but these different things that have to interlace, and that the tension needs to be right according to the place, time, people, etc. It
occurs to me it's kind of about navigating difference, isn't it? Learning to do that.
And also when the tension is too much. I remember doing a course at the Blue Mountains. I personally like to weave on a very, very, very high tension, which like is not cool in weaving circles, but it just feels good. And I was weaving on such high tension that the beam of my loom just snapped in half. And I can say the same for shows that I've curated. So, yeah.
I guess just thinking about work that's loaded, I mean, all of that speaks about work that's loaded and has content that's can sometimes be heavy. Just to draw the conversation to Annie's quote about any material being able to take on the burden of the artist's thinking or dreaming or their preoccupation, what they're dwelling on. And when I look through the work here, one of the most common concerns is environmental, which is kind of not surprising given we're in a climate crisis and biodiversity crisis and the rest. We've got examples here from Kelly's reflection on living in an extractive mining zone, Jane's bushfire response, and my own consideration of the fibre shed above sourcing from my bone bioregion. Thinking back on the meaning of the word matter, by the way, we talked about physical substance and a meaning or significance. One of the third definitions I came across from matter was actually the effluent from an organic being. Or that, I can't remember what they gave examples of, you know, like I was thinking phlegm and, you know, feces and stuff. But I realised, oh, hair is probably in that category. So I ticked that box with utilising my hair in the work, that other meaning of matter. But Monique, I just wondered if you could tell us how your concerns played out in the work you've created, your environmental concerns.
Well, for me it seems a little obvious that I don't like people rubbishing, and I think that we produce works, pieces in our lives that are destructive, even though it might give us a moment of joy. Environmental concerns, yeah. So in my work, I like to think I make a reasonable, nice picture, but at the same time I still like to have a slight... oh, moment when people come closer, when they realise that little bit that sticks out is actually a piece of an old face mask or a piece of McDonald's cup paper. But, so there's something about my how I like to do it is something that people hopefully enjoy looking at or are slightly shocked by. Yeah.
Thank you.
And it means people need to come closer. So some of the work here, there's like electrical bits and this and that, and you wouldn't know if you saw it from a distance, but when you come closer, it's there.
Yeah, thank you.
We've almost reached time. In fact, I think we've hit time, but I have a couple of questions I'd like to squeeze in, if it's okay, Katie.
Yes.
Annie Albers credited the Weavers of Peru as her teachers in her foreword to On Weaving. And many of these artists reference or incorporate traditional weaving methods, often blending them with contemporary approaches. I just wanted to invite Amanda to speak to us about Shifu and that heritage, if you're willing, Amanda.
My pieces are based on Shifu, which is a Japanese term for paper cloth woven with paper, yarn. I did learn that technique in Japan, and part of it was looking back into the history of the technique. Before, in sort of ancient times, fabric made from clothing made from cloth, or cloth as we know it, is actually very precious and very expensive. And so poorer farmers, they would actually recycle paper and spin them into yarn and weave them into cloth to make them into clothing as well, because it's that part of understanding the material, how to use their characteristics to make them stronger. And because you don't normally think of a piece of paper as something that is strong and resilient and can be waterproof. So in this instance, I was thinking about paper as used in fabric, but also paper we use as a communication tool for correspondence, but we don't really do that anymore. We tend to send email. We don't really write letters as much. And also a lot of... So the paper that has the darker colouring are actually old books that I've cut up to make into paper yarn. So they embed the ink and the writing. But nowadays, I think sometimes when I look at my nephew's writing, they're really terrible. I can't read them anymore. And then they would look at an old postcard that my mum would have written to me in cursive writing, and they can't read that either, because they can only read text that are typed out on their phone. And also text from ancient or even characters. I'm Chinese, so and I grew up in Hong Kong, so I grew up with the traditional characters, but nowadays a lot of characters are simplified and you can't really look at the character and understand its meaning anymore. So part of that is to do with communication, paper, clothing. So it's just sort of like a whole domino effect of what one material can do for us in society, and how I feel like sometimes it's disappearing, and how do we get it back. And the handmade paper that I used used to be a common thing, but now handmade paper is really expensive and it becomes something that is made into art rather than things that you use every day. So it's like a circle of
value.
Yeah. Mm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Thanks, Amanda. Do you see how much there are in and under these works? They're so rich. So to close, I want to read a quote that Liz opened the show with last year in Sydney, one of her favourites from Annie Albers' book On Designing. Our world goes to pieces. We have to rebuild our world.
We investigate and worry and analyse and forget that the new comes about through exuberance. We have to find our strength rather than our weakness. If we want to learn to do, to form, we have to turn the artwork. We have to turn to artwork, and more specifically to craft work. And I think that's as true now as it was in Annie's time. I think Jane's regeneration work from the bushfires is a recognition of nature doing that. The exuberance that comes after a fire in the regrowth. And just also Hannah here, the gold weaving, it was her dream to catch a light and its fleeting moments of luminescence. I think she's succeeded in that. So the last question I have is, where might textiles lead us next? What role might weaving or art play in shaping a constructive future? Are you up for that, Malik?
Maybe Blake.
I was hoping you would. Well, it got us here. Actually, for me, that there's a bit of a losing Liz. Liz was always the pathway forward, actually, for many people in the textile community, because no one else could kind of keep a community going in the way that Liz managed to. And yeah, for me, that's like quite a big question, because when, you know, you're connected to a group of people or a place because of someone that's now not there, how do I now do that? So, you know, I mean, the future, as in the world not imploding, I'm not sure, but my immediate little future is just to try and honour what Liz would have wanted in exhibitions like this, but also to keep people connected. Liz was an absolute master at that, her legacy in that sense of keeping textile people informed is something that, you know, I feel a little responsibility to carry on. And just in the little things, like dropping, you know, I'm going to Canberra, like to drop in on that weaver who lives in Canberra or Newcastle or whatever, which you otherwise wouldn't do unless Liz made you, like, or go to a residency. So, yeah, there's that.
I just had a recollection of having Liz as a student. Can you imagine? No pressure. At Sturt last year, or the year before, I can't recall. And she just blended in. She didn't impose anything, dynamically on the group. And at the end of the week, what Liz asked was, oh, would everyone like to come to my place in a few weeks and we can catch up on how we're going without braiding and swap notes and have a meal together? And at that point, I really wished I lived in Sydney. So, yeah, I agree, Blake. She was very, very good at that. Monique?
Yeah, so in my mind, if we talk about Liz, I feel like I know there's a few gaps and I know maybe I need to step in. So I'm sort of readying myself for that. And I think we'll just keep going with what we are doing and being strong about asserting ourselves about weaving and textiles and its importance in our lives. Hopefully just to be continued without Liz, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's true to say that she's in all of the works in this room in one way or another, and certainly within all of our lives. So thank you, Liz, and thank you all for joining me in honouring her today. See you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ilka. Thank you, Blake. Thank you, Monique. Thank you for those thoughtful and mindful reflections and storytelling. And thank you to Jacqueline and Amanda for contributing in that storytelling. And thank you to all of you for making the journey to Ararat. It's a delight to host you today. The gallery is open until 4 o'clock today, so please do spend some more time in the exhibition here, soak up these works. We also have two other exhibitions in the other spaces on the other side of the building. There's a showcase of the Tamar collection and mother-daughter touring exhibition, the works of Heather and Kate Durra. And refreshments will now be served in the gallery foyer. Thank you for supporting us this afternoon. And please join me in further thanking Ilka Blake and Monique.